Hello and welcome to Workhorse, the podcast about Royal Australian Air Force C-130 Hercules aircraft. Today we're talking about search and rescue in the 1975 to 1986 era. I'm your host, Bill Korolakos. Some of you know me as K-9. I served over 30 years in the Canadian and Australian Air Forces, primarily in air mobility roles. In this historically informative podcast series, I cover the entire history of Australian C-130s, including a look at how Australian history was shaped by Australia's Hercules aircraft. This podcast series is generally chronological, and it's based upon an extensive history book I wrote about Australian Air Force C-130s titled Air Mobility Workhorse, which should be published in late 2024. In the last episode, we talked about how the 1975 to 86 era brought about increasing numbers of C-130 humanitarian assistance disaster relief missions. This was all part of the shift to Defence of Australia. In addition to the HADR, domestic aeromedical evacuation and search and rescue tasking also occupied much of the Hercules program during the era of the 76 White Paper, which is what we're talking about. Federal and state governments came to depend on C-130s for this type of assistance. Typically, these missions were assigned with little or no warning, and as such, they were often assigned to what was known as the standby crew. The C-130 force routinely maintained crews and a serviceable aircraft on standby at Richmond, primarily for search and rescue, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Some other missions occasionally required crews to be on standby, but by and large, it was for search and rescue. A crew on standby was either already at Richmond or airborne on another task. Alternatively, the standby crew members were at home ready to get in their car and head into work at the drop of a hat. This meant standby crews were unable to consume alcohol and could not be more than 1 to 2 hours drive from Richmond if they weren't already flying or at the base. The typical search and rescue requirements of the time stipulated that either a C-130 or a P-3 would be on a 3 to 4 hour or a 12-hour standby for any emergency callout. While Mirages were flying at Williamtown, for example, there was also a requirement to have a Hercules on a 20-minute standby. But of course, the Mirage standby was not the normal search and rescue mission for C-130s. A typical search and rescue mission was one that involved, say, a boat off the coast that was in trouble. An example of one was a twin-engine 14-meter luxury cruiser called the Nocturne, which got into trouble while sailing between Brisbane and Newcastle on the 22nd and 23rd of September 1979. At the helm of the Nocturne was a seasoned sailor, Frank Markwell, and the passengers were two couples in their 20s. Winds of over 100 kilometers an hour created a 6-meter swell that smashed windscreens and swamped the two engines. Frank transmitted a distress call saying he was 3 to 10 nautical miles off the coast near Evans Head. Some vessels in the area responded to the call, but the weather was too rough for the seagoing rescuers to continue. A C-130H crew was on search and rescue standby at the time, and that crew launched from Richmond at 9:20 a.m. on the 24th of September. The Hercules searched in conjunction with other small aircraft, but to no avail. However, a P-3 was diverted to the area and found the wreckage of the Nocturne, 12 nautical miles east of Ballina. Miraculously, they also spotted, clinging to the wreckage, three survivors. A combined RAF effort ensued to save the beleaguered sailors. The P-3 vectored the Herc to the scene, and a RAF rescue helicopter, which had been pre-positioned to Evans Head just in case, came in from Amberley and departed Evans Head at 1:45 p.m. The pilots of the Iroquois, by the way, was Flight Lieutenant Angus Houston, who we all know, of course, became Chief of the Defence Force and Air Chief Marshal Sir Angus Houston. And he recalled, and this was out of a newspaper, the Herc and Orion were marking the area with smoke, making it easier for us to acquire the target. Houston lowered one of his crewmen on a cable 30 to 50 feet below the helicopter, where a huge swell smashed the rescuer, almost turning it into a double search and rescue mission. But demonstrating great courage, that crew persevered and winched the first survivor to safety, and that was the skipper, Frank Markwell. And guided by the P-3 and the Herc, the Iroquois found the other two survivors, who were Ray Moran and his wife Maria. They were half a mile away, and they managed to get them out of the water too. Houston and his helicopter took the survivors to the Ballina Hospital while the search continued for Bill and Philippa Moran. For 2 days, a C-130, a P-3, several light aircraft searched the ocean, but they didn't find the unlucky couple. Frank Markwell and his two passengers were fortunate that the Herc and the P-3 crews were trained to consider the effects of wind and current and to conduct a methodical search of the general area. That example of a search and rescue mission highlights the criticality of making a radio call, and ideally giving the correct location of the endangered people. All too often, those missions were launched to find a ship or a small craft that did not have the foresight to make a call while their radios were still working, if they even had a radio at all. And one example from that era was a ship called the Charleston, which in January 1980 decided to leave Hobart for Sydney without a working radio. And he sailed into a storm in the Bass Straits. By the time the authorities realized that boat was missing, the search and rescue mission consumed 122 hours of C-130 and P-3 time, and all in vain because they never found that yacht. A few years later, there were a few sailors from PNG in a small boat called the Matina, and they were far more fortunate than the Charleston. On the 16th of April, 1987, Flying Officer Steve Rudders Rutley and his crew were in A-97-189, and they flew from Richmond up to Port Moresby to look for this vessel. Although they were unable to find the vessel, they managed to get into radio contact with it, and an Army Lieutenant Colonel who spoke some Pidgin was on board the aircraft with them, and he was able to get the sailors to advise what time sunset occurred at their location. Using that time, the navigator, Pilot Officer Dean T-Bag Tetley, calculated the longitude of the missing vessel. Although the Herc couldn't continue that day, they came back the next day after having spent the night at Cavieng, and they arrived at 8:30 in the morning in the approximate area and searched along that derived line of longitude. And within half an hour, lo and behold, there was the Matina, only 2 miles from the longitude that Dean Tetley had predicted. An air-sea rescue kit was dropped to the stricken sailors, and they were rescued that night by the PNG Defense Force. And T-Bag received a commendation for his actions. Those sorts of search and rescue missions were commonplace in the 75 to 86 era, and there were some really good words penned by Kevin Henderson, who was commanding Officer 36 Squadron, and he commented about the rough weather and survival techniques he'd observed during his time as a CO. His personal experiences included captaining a Herc that found the survivors of the Phaedra at last light, and he attributed that success to a flare the survivors fired, enabling him to guide a nearby ship to rescue the survivors. He noted that high seas, clouds, and rain make finding a small boat or people in the water really difficult, and as such, he asked sailors, in an article that he wrote, to take an array of signaling devices on every trip, so a radio, flares, an emergency beacon, etc. And when you think about it, a marinized beacon is relatively inexpensive compared to the cost of a boat or one's life. And beacons are probably the best signaling device that a Herc can track in on when looking for a ship that's lost at sea. Of course, we can't talk about search and rescue without talking about the equipment drops that were done in support of search and rescue, and AMTDU was pretty central to this. With parachutes being a costly item, one which the Army probably didn't want Air Force to be using if you couldn't get the parachute back, there was a perceived need for a way of dropping equipment without a parachute. The RAF was also asked by Darwin Search and Rescue Flights if it could find a way to drop supplies to motorists stranded in remote regions of Australia. And it was apparent to 36 Squadron that there would also be utility for Macquarie Island drops for such an airdrop system. Although the Dizzy Lizzy was available at the time for dropping a few kilos of goods, during an AMTDU visit to their sister unit in the United Kingdom, and that unit's called the Joint Air Delivery Test and Evaluation Unit, or JADTU for short, AMTDU staff observed a cardboard CDS that was used for water drops in the Falklands War. Bill Matteys returned to Australia with the concept of using cardboard to deliver a parachuteless container that could be dropped with more weight than a Dizzy Lizzy. So based on the Dizzy Lizzy concept, which was introduced by Bob Shorty Heffernan, in other words, a cardboard box that had little winglets on it and spun to slow its rate of descent, An improved design was developed by Flight Lieutenants Gavin Harry Seacom and Lyndon Wigmore, both pilots, and veteran Loadmaster Warrant Officer Neville Big Nev Schroeder. The Helibox, which is what it was called, was tested over a series of 50 trial drops, and the final solution was about one-fifth the price of a small parachute, and it was rated to carry up to 45 kilos, although I can't imagine how hard it would land at that weight. The Helibox design was so innovative that it won a Packaging Council of Australia Development Award in 1984. And the Helibox became a regular feature in C-130 Hercules airdrop operations, including search and rescues. It was also used to support special forces for minor resupply drops and for a variety of other minor resupply missions. C-130s tended to carry a few of these for unexpected search and rescue missions because loadmasters could rig one in flight, and they could be dropped with fairly good accuracy in almost any conditions. One such example was a 37 squadron drop to Canadian researchers in Antarctica that were monitoring South Pole seabirds at a remote site in 1989. While they were there for a survival course, loadmasters Truck McConnell and Daryl Bent organized to drop some beer, rations, and entertainment magazines in a helibox, and these were much appreciated by the very lonely Canadians. Another airdroppable load AMTDU improved was the Lindholm Rescue Kit that saved many people in the years since it was invented, which was back in World War II. The Lindholm Kit was replaced by the Air Sea Rescue Kit, or ASRK for short, and that was done after a series of trials conducted by AMTDU in the early 1980s. And for those P3 fans out there, the P3s didn't adopt the ASRK until 1988. The ASRK was a similar configuration to the Lindholm in that it had five containers attached by about 500 meters of wax rope. The two end containers contained rafts with two radios in each raft, and the other three containers had survival equipment and supplies. The ASRK remained largely unchanged since it was invented, and it's been very successful in saving lives throughout the Australian search and rescue region, which, by the way, is about 11% of the Earth's surface. Well, that was a bit of a snapshot on search and rescue in the 75 to 86 era. There were hundreds of them launched in that time frame. Can't cover them all, of course. The examples I've given you here today give you a bit of a snapshot of what it was like to do a search and rescue mission. And of course, some of them were bigger than others, such as the Isabelle Letissier rescue in the Southern Ocean. Well, that's it for this week. Next episode, we'll be talking about operations in the Middle East between 75 and 86. And if you know anyone that enjoys military history, aviation, or ever flew in a C-130, please tell them about this podcast. Thanks for listening.